through his physical life, which includes the manifestation of his mental and emotional patterns, may very well be heavily influenced by the way it is fed. I think there is no doubt in the world that the unusual increase in various forms of psychic and psychological difficulties can be in part at least attributed to the excessive abuse of medications and a definite failure of right nutritional patterns. If the individual is improperly nourished, he is uncomfortable, and discomfort is the beginning of misery, and misery spreads. The individual who is physically uncomfortable or is physically without adequate supporting energy is a natural possibility for psychic depression. If his energies do not maintain him, if he doesn't get up in the morning feeling like facing the day with a good hope, if he has to crawl around hour after hour, half dead, it is very easy for him to fall into negative mental and emotional patterns. And if this goes on long enough and he has recourse to stimulants to get a day's work done, he is on his way to further trouble. Therefore, I have observed that in a great many cases, people suffering from various psychic and psychological disturbances are suffering from malnutrition or from various faulty types of nutrition. We have to realize that in order to maintain the relationship between the mental emotional structure and the physical nervous system, the machinery has to be in reasonable functioning order. If you have a beautiful television set and a bad tube in it, the pattern, the program, will never come through distinctly. You will have distortion. And these problems that we are concerned with are distortions. They are something that is not coming through correctly. So we must begin to take consideration of these possibilities. There are all kinds of circumstances that can lead to an upset in the biochemical balance of the human body. If this is badly unbalanced, we will have mental and emotional symptoms as inevitable results. One problem that we can have, for example, is through over-medication, that we have unbalanced the natural aptitudes and functions of the organs or the various chemical processes of the body. We can open ourselves to one kind of sickness while taking medications against another. We also know that we are all subject to adulterated foods and various substitutions within our food patterns. We know that we are not able to be sure that poisonous materials are not present in at least small degrees in many food products as preservatives, and that gradually we may be undermining our health in the vain process of trying to keep alive. Though probably the system will handle a certain amount of this abuse with fair ease. And if the nature is otherwise well integrated, the person may have an occasional spell of low vitality, but he'll snap out of it. If, however, the nature is at the same time naturally neurotic and its energy resources are depressed, it is more and more easy to fall into holes in the dark. And these holes in the dark nearly always develop some kind of psychosomatic symbols. These holes in the dark never simply speak to us with some ghostly voice and say, "You're short on calcium." We never get this kind of a situation. What we have is the same hollow voice warning us that some neighbor of ours is working witchcraft on us. Our minds never seem to run to the subjective statement of reasonable things. They always get a little strange when they don't feel good. And this danger is so common in symptomology that any physician knows all about it and has encountered it countless times. In cases where proper remedies cleared it up and there could be no correction, no doubt as to the correctness of his diagnosis. So we have this type of thing to consider. We have the problem of exercise, the proper maintenance of the body. We have the problem of carbon monoxide, of various sterilizers in the water system of a city. We have every type of thing you can think of, fighting with our health and our survival. Not necessarily killing us, that would be rather too simple. Rather letting us suffer for a long time in a state of being about two-thirds alive and one-third dead. Now, the one-third that is dead, however, will never lie down. That one-third will haunt the other two-thirds as long as we live. Then when we get a little further along in this problem, I've noticed a number of other problems that have come along that are interesting. Just as surely as we have physical allergies, we have psychic allergy. Some individuals cannot wear wool without breaking out as though they had strawberry rash. Another individual cannot stand a certain type of house paint. He breaks out with a rash that looks as though he had been rolling around in a bed of poison ivy. All kinds of allergies arise in the personal life. Now, we all also have psychic allergies. We all of us have certain things which psychically or psychologically we particularly resent. When we get too close to these things or they move in upon us, we promptly get sick. We rebel against them. And just as certain types of poison can cause convulsion, so we can have a very definite psychic convulsion. If we are exposed long enough to certain psychic pressures, which pressures they are in each individual, we can only learn as we learn what allergies may be from a great deal of testing. But it is perfectly possible for an individual, otherwise quite happy and contented, to have powerful psychic antipathies to people, powerful psychic affinities to undesirable circumstances or characteristics, or to be in a position or condition to be made sick by the repetition of an event. All this type of thing may have its bearing on the psychic integration of the person. We could go on to a great many other different problems. Does any, for instance, defect in hearing or defect in vision, or the injury to any of the sensory perceptions, or a basic permanent injury to some part of the nervous system, or an old chronic accident. These can all give trouble. Then there's another thing that can give so much trouble that we almost think that it represents one of the primary curses of the human race, and that is poor elimination. Poor elimination is responsible for more pseudo-yogi experiences than any single cause. The individual becomes so toxic that he's not sure whether he's heading for perdition or nirvana. He can have everything that would normally be associated with narcotic or alcoholic intoxication. And neither the narcotic addict nor the alcoholic very often sees anything nice. He always sees hurtful, dangerous, evil things, slimy things, things that seem to arise from some strange, lower world, not things that are beautiful and fine and noble. simply because the psychic integration will not permit him to live on a level of alcoholism and at the same time of the capacity to experience subjectively beautiful experiences. It's just not possible within the gamut of the human framework that such things should occur. Then we do have the lurking possibility, always, of course, of genuine mental disease. We have the possibility that the individual is sick, sicker than he realizes. But this, in most cases, is not essentially true. I have seen a great many cases in which the patient would certainly have been regarded as an advanced mental case by any normal mental specialist who did get himself out of his condition well and did pull out and make an excellent recovery without medical help at all, simply because it is almost impossible today to detect the difference between a pseudo-ailment and a genuine expression of the same situation. So in most cases, I would feel that the danger of a serious mental situation does not develop unless the situation now existing has been allowed to endure for a great many years without any effort to correct it, without any willingness to impose self-discipline upon emotions or upon mental attitudes. The individual who simply takes the bit in his teeth and determines to do exactly as he pleases, regardless of everything, is always a potential psychotic. But where intentions have been good, where the ailments are comparatively mild, and where the difficulty, though real, is regarded with a certain amount of common sense and sincere desire to improve or correct, we do not have too much serious mental difficulty. It is most often a situation of excessive bewilderment, a condition in which the person is unable to orient his own attitude. Another point that we do find now is that coming a little more into prevalence, and we have to watch it, is malnutrition due to excessive dieting and diet fads. Now, while there is much to point out the importance of certain reasonable diets, unreasonable dieting likely to reduce the vitality of the individual, or making promises of providing adequate vitality, which promises are not kept when the individual takes the dosage recommended, or the person who becomes fad-ridden on the subject, is very likely to lower his vitality. And if he does lower his vitality, we have to realize that malnutrition is one of the basic factors in the stimulation of psychic symptoms. The individual who is most likely to get into psychic difficulties is not essentially very healthy to start with, physically. Sometimes they are overweight. This is quite common of psychics. Overweight due to lymphatic and glandular imbalance. Sometimes they have debility due to failure to take in the food materials, which are the first line of defense against psychic pressure. And these are the foods that the dieter is most inclined to avoid, carbohydrates and proteins. We are now, of course, inclined to favor high-protein diets. But the carbohydrates are the ones that keep the individual with his feet very much physically on the ground. Now, he cannot always take them in excess, but where he cuts them too low, where he takes them entirely out of his diet, or tries to get along with almost none of them, he is almost certain to create greater activity of the pituitary And when he does this, he is more inclined to have visions or hallucinational experiences. So that when we get someone who's in trouble, we try to check some of these things to find out whether the difficulty arises from some basic mistake that the person is making. If we find that this physical situation does exist, then it is obviously the first area in which correction should be made. The individual, incidentally, who will not correct these simple physical situations, if they are found to be present, is a very poor candidate for any psychological correction. If he will not do the common, simple things that other people in all areas of life have learned to do, it is very difficult to convince him to do any extraordinary things. And here's where, of course, the old magicians wage their strange magic warfare of their own. And it's a complicated and curious world, and it leads to all kinds of deceits and difficulties. But our ancestors long ago began to be rather shrewd about these things. They said to themselves, let's assume for a moment that this individual is frightening himself to death. We can send him to the priest or the philosopher who will counsel him. We can send him to the doctor who will warn him. But this individual has reached a state of fear hysteria in which he simply won't listen. If you tell him that his trouble is simply due to his own loss of self-control, he will go to some other person to consult someone who has greater spiritual insight, because he knows perfectly well that he is innocent of all evil and has just been picked out to become a universal martyr. So if we don't appreciate this, he hunts for someone who does. And he'll always find them in the course of time. But his condition will remain the same or get worse. But this he doesn't realize. But back in the days when these problems were perhaps more prevalent than they are now, our ancestors developed probably quite subconsciously a strategy to handle them. The individual who was the victim of his own fear evidently was quite an impressionable soul. He was easily impressed by something, even if it was only fear. Therefore, you could use his own impressionability to create a new attitude. So the remedy consisted of giving him another magical factor which would give him self-confidence. You sort of used one remedy against another. If you found the person was suffering as the result of frightening himself out of his wits, you then gave him a sort of courage potion that would make him believe that he was master of all he surveyed. Now, this courage potion could be most anything. It could be an amulet that he wore on his hand or around his neck, which made him very certain that while he wore this amulet that had been blessed and had been properly consecrated for the purpose, that none of these spooks could get near him. And, of course, if he was devout and the amulet had sufficient authority back of it, he probably didn't have any more trouble. He had changed his own basic thinking. The same problem very largely applies when we're trying to get people today out of moral difficulties. If we can cause these people to believe that there is a moral force in nature which can help them, which is stronger than their own moral weakness, if through prayer or meditation or concentration or through some simple religious exercise these people come to believe that they have available to them some source of good that is greater than themselves. They then develop a kind of new courage, a courage that may be stronger than the fear that hurt them before. This gives them a new look at life, a new point of view. They suddenly say to themselves, I can control this situation. I can master it. I am bigger than the situation. And if they will repeat that inwardly in themselves and come to really believe it, they can break down the counter-suggestion that is causing the trouble. So we have here a battle of suggestions. We have an effort to substitute a constructive attitude for a destructive one. And that is the way that most ancient peoples fought out this particular difficulty. And they found that the most useful agencies in accomplishing these ends were religion, which gave the individual a faith in God, philosophy, which gave an individual a faith in truth or a faith in right, and in some attitudes, in some areas, science, which gave him a faith in skill or the ability of the physician to bring about the cure. Even today, many rural doctors have found there is no medication equal to a bread pill. Today, however, they don't use bread so much. Cornstarch is the favorite in capsules. And if the capsule is large and hard to swallow, it is much more efficacious. But these people realize that, many doctors realize that the patient is frightened. Frightened not because they are really sick, but because of some strange symptom. Perhaps they have bought the old almanac and have found that they have all the ailments that are threatened in the almanac. So the doctor gives them the universal cure-all and they feel better very, very rapidly. Of course, we also had in the old days a number of most efficacious tonics that were used by the farming people very extensively. We don't know too much about the more subtle ingredients of the tonic, but there's no doubt that the 18% alcohol was beneficial. The individual certainly was cheered by this addition to his diet, and it was possible for respectable teetotalers to use it because it was a medicine. So whatever changes these attitudes often breaks up problems. But unfortunately, we can't always depend even upon this type of situation for help. We have the person who really or psychologically, however we want to view it, is in trouble. He is in trouble to the point that it seems as though there is no easy way out for him. He has gotten himself mixed up in a situation of which neither he nor anyone else can actually wave a magic wand and bring about his recovery. Many of these people who get into difficulties as a result of organizations that they have belonged to write to the leaders of these organizations and ask for help. Usually the leaders cannot give them any, because the leader himself doesn't know what to do with this kind of problem. The member believes that the organization is to blame. Actually, the organization carries only secondary responsibility. There has to be something in the person who is in trouble that made it almost inevitable that he would be in trouble. And if he had not joined that organization, he would have joined another one. And if he had joined no organization, he would have still had a nervous breakdown from the pressures of his own personality. So the individual is really in serious trouble, but still sufficiently integrated to realize that he is in serious trouble, has to face a rather long and thorough process of rehabilitation. he has to recover just exactly as a narcotics addict has to recover. He has to do it the slow, hard way. And he should have a certain amount of directive. But if he is not willing to follow directive, there is no power in the world that can force him to do so. So presuming that we have one of two situations, which as far as their treatment is concerned, is the same for both. Suppose we want to say now that the individual is suffering from some form of a possessing or obsessing entity. And that in this case we wish to affirm that this entity is a psychic entity, and therefore that the individual is actually what he thinks he is, or what his symptoms might cause others to believe that he is, namely possessed by a being apart from himself. Let's assume that this is one possibility. Or let us assume, as a second parallel possibility, that this so-called possession or obsession is a pressure area of his own nature, which has taken over the dominion of his life and refuses to relinquish its leadership, so that the direct, integrated consciousness itself can resume its proper relationship to the rest of the personality. In other words, that the obsession or possession is either psychic or psychological. Now, in either instance, and the problem is essentially the same in both cases, whatever is done must be done to reorganize the power of the entity itself. If that is, in this case, the person's own entity. The consciousness of the individual must be restored to leadership. It must be restored to leadership because it is able either to displace some other entity or displace some other area of pressure that has usurped authority. In the final analysis, it really makes very little difference. What cures one will cure the other. What is not sufficient for one is not sufficient for the other. We all realize that no matter how we want to view this, the most destructive emotion in the universe is fear. Fear is the greatest killer that we know. Fear can stop your heart as quick as a bullet. Fear can stop any function of the body, the emotions, or the mind. And an extraordinary paroxysm of fear or of terror can accomplish almost as much damage within the body of a human being as the release of a hydrogen bomb. Fear, as the ancients all pointed out, is that emotion which creates a relation of negation, by means of which the individual is open to everything that is bad, everything that is weak, everything that is wrong. There is nothing that can create a criminal more rapidly than fear, even though he may be full of bravado about it. There is nothing that can cause us to compromise our ethics any more rapidly than fear. There is nothing that can destroy our integration, our orientation in life, more rapidly than fear. And according to most psychics who have explored the invisible constitution of man, fear destroys all the natural defense mechanisms of the magnetic field against the possibilities of obsession, the possibilities of infection by bacterial organisms, or the possibilities of contagion. And these fear motives also destroy the power of the body to take in energy by closing, compressing the various channels through which vitality can reach the body. Therefore, fear completely enervates in time. It leads to all kinds of desperate actions and usually causes the individual to multiply his karma manyfold very quickly. If, therefore, a person is fearful, he becomes wide open to every negative factor of life, the universe around him, and the pressures of his own personality within him. Fear lowers his defenses and his resistances. And when anything becomes the object of fear, the individual who is frightened is defeated then and there. Consequently, fear will help to intensify any type of psychotic situation. As surely as fear is the great destroyer, as we have mentioned, faith is the universal medicine. So fear is the poison, and faith is the remedy for nearly every situation that can arise. If the individual wishes to assume that he is the victim of an obsessing being of some kind, the only possible way of outwitting this situation is to remove the importance of it as a psychic factor in the integration of the person. If he will not be afraid, if he simply declines to fear, no negative factor can get very close to him. And any factor negative that is close to him can no longer achieve any particular effect. And we may assume that nothing in nature will remain indefinitely engaged in a profitless undertaking. The moment the individual ceases to be afraid, he mends the tears in his own magnetic field. Fear opens the solar plexus. And whatever mysterious negative forces we believe to exist outside of us, the solar plexus becomes the mirror of death. These forces move in through the opening of the negative areas of life. Everything that is evil is essentially negative. Everything that is destructive is negative, because negativity is destruction. Everything that tears down is negative. And everything that supports negation increases and enlarges it. A person who is negative is in trouble. But if to this negation is added jealousy, we have a double negative, and the individual is in more trouble. If his natural negation plus the jealousy increases worry, he has three negative factors. If later, in addition to worry, comes criticism or some form of hate, we have more negative factors. So everything that is wrong builds up negatives. And when the individual has enough negatives, he falls apart. When he has enough negative situations, the individual himself ceases. The individual is nothing but a mass of worries, fears, anxieties, neuroses, selfish pressures, self-interest, self-centeredness. All of these negative things, when there is nothing but this type of thing functioning in the individual's life, or at least these hopelessly overbalance every other consideration, the individual simply ceases to be an individual. After John Doe has enough of this negation built up in him, he simply isn't John Doe any longer. He is simply a hole in a psychological darkness. And you can call him John Doe if you want to, but his real name is negation. And the real name of the devil in ancient times was also negation. So this negative situation means that the person has voluntarily relinquished the leadership on his own life. He has turned it over to his anxieties, to his doubts, to his timidities, his uncertainties, and to a large degree, his natural orneriness. He has found, or to his own satisfaction, that he'd much rather be angry than be healthy. Only he doesn't make the comparison. But as by degrees he relinquishes his integrity center, he simply ceases. Now there is an old saying that some ancient scientist is credited with, to the effect that nature abhors a vacuum. When the individual has made a first-class vacuum out of himself, so that he's nothing but a mysterious whirl of darkness surrounded by trouble, this individual may then be said to be in a condition suitable to be obsessed by anything that comes along is stronger than he is. He could be obsessed by the ego or the libido of an insect. Because at least an insect in its short life has some purpose. It is fulfilling its destiny. But this person is no longer fulfilling any destiny. Simply a derelict. A drifting ship waiting to be salvaged by something. Well, this isn't the way the person feels about it, but these are the gloomy facts that the third person has to take into consideration. If we assume that the negative person is apt to be obsessed by some other entity, it is easy to understand why such an individual would be obsessed. And it is also very easy to understand that anything that would obsess such a person has to be pretty no count itself. Because no entity of great value, power, and insight is going to obsess an integration that is so negative and so worthless that nothing good can be expected from it. And what happens? Wherever an obsession situation does appear, the individual simply becomes worse. He gradually gets pulled further and further into hopelessness, helplessness, and fear. The obsession never makes a man out of a fool. But it can apparently sometimes make a fool out of an individual who internally is already well along the way of foolishness. Now, if you want to, on the other hand, assume that it isn't an entity, but that it is a part of the individual's own consciousness that is moving in, then we know that the part is always less than the whole, that the partial consciousness never has the morality, the ethics, the convictions, the idealism, the aspirations, which can only result from the consciousness itself ensouling its own emotional and mental vehicles. So if one of these lesser vehicles takes over, the individual's morality immediately lowers. And another symptom is that when the consciousness loses control and these lower parts take over, there is a physical demoralization. The body becomes also disintegrated in some respect or other. The individual develops very rapidly extraordinary grandeur symptoms. The individual becomes less coordinated. The body becomes sloppy, hopeless, no longer effective, because the consciousness is not leading it. and that part of the entity which is leading it isn't strong enough. So when we get a poor government and we force the proper ruler out of office, we naturally expect the empire to decay, and it does. The whole personality falls apart. And some one of these several different personalities which can exist, sometimes more than one fighting for dominion, will create a multiple personality problem. But in all these multiple personalities, there will very seldom be found anything that is truly noble, truly really fine. There may be different levels of inadequacy, some vicious, some merely helpless. But we will never find that the individual ruled by a fragment of himself has the same wisdom and insight that he has when he is ruled by all of himself. So what do we have? We have two problems. Either the individual is ruled by something else which can never rule him properly because it wasn't created for that purpose, or he is ruled by part of himself which cannot rule properly because it does not possess the total insight necessary for leadership. Wherever this kind of condition occurs, there is only one possible answer. The controlling power must be restored. That which is the self in the individual must be again seated on the seat of authority. And this cannot generally be accomplished without some real, sincere, continuing personal effort. The individual who is weak cannot become strong unless he exercises his powers and faculties and builds strength. He cannot have the wisdom to restore himself unless he becomes basically wiser than the situation in which he is involved. Therefore, for this type of person, only philosophic insight, sincerely and earnestly sought, and wisely applied, and everything else that is needed to cultivate, culture, and normalize the life of the person must be cultivated. The individual must be lifted out of every negative pattern and brought back into self-respect, self-discipline, and reasonable coordination. Unless these things are done, there cannot be an adequate remedy. Usually the adequate remedy is not found. The individual simply drifts along until the causes themselves or other causes remove him from life. But it is possible at any time to overcome these situations if we really determine to do so. It is this degree of determination which must be the best and only really practical therapy. We cannot expect others to solve these problems. We cause them over a long period of time. Sometimes they're karmic. We must solve them by becoming greater than the problem. And nearly all great systems of enlightenment, of religion and philosophy, and of the higher aesthetic arts and sciences were created to assist the individual in two ways. First, assist him to maintain proper self-leadership. And second, to help him to restore proper self-leadership if it is lost. And only through the cultivation of these abilities and aptitudes can we put this fragmented personality back together again under the leadership which was intended in nature. And it is only when this is done that our problem is solved. Well, our time is up, so we'll have to go into this a little more next week when we will continue some of this basic thinking. Thank you very much.